In a world brimming with complexity, few creatures embody harmony like the honeybee. With tireless precision, she dances from bloom to bloom, each motion guided by millennia upon millennia of instinct, each act in service to the whole. And then there are the beekeepers, watchful stewards of this ancient symbiosis. Part agri-scientist, part poet, they move along their hives with the efficiency of Moe, Larry, and Curly, tending to the bees' needs as best they can comprehend, and with the infrequency of a waterfall in the Sahara, sometimes running off, flapping and flailing like a penguin on a hot sidewalk. This is their journey.
Welcome, welcome to Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by our great friends over at Man Lake. Today's guest has an apiary and beekeeping business on the Big Island of Hawaii. Yes, I'm still there, and it is raining in paradise today, but that's okay. Our guest and his partner focus solely on regenerative and treatment-free beekeeping. Now, I know you're saying, Eric, you've just opened up a giant can of worms by discussing one of the most polarizing topics in beekeeping. Okay, let's all just take a breath. If you're new to the show, let me explain something. We are not here to tell you how you must do your beekeeping. We're here to share information. Then it's up to you to decide what's best for your bees and the style of beekeeping that feels most right to you. It's been said that beekeeping is a blend of science and soul. So do your homework, get in touch with your bees, and do what your soul tells you. Before we jump into that, I know we've all heard about, read about, and seen with our own two eyes, most of us, the wackle dance that bees do. Well, we can always learn more. There is a new research study out where the waggle dance of the honeybees was researched. It's always been thought that the waggle dance is something that just points the direction for the bees in which they should go to find sources of nectar and pollen. But a recent study published in Current Biology investigated the remarkable communication strategy to a whole new level. Some of what they learned is that bees use their own memory of the topography, the terrain around them, as they interpret this waggle dance, and the two work together. Let me just quote from some of it. Did the dance teach the bees? If you can imagine a bee moving with fear, though emotion didn't play into its study, to anticipate a bump in the road at a specific point on the journey. Are the bees, in fact, pantomiming the way itself? I'm getting wet. Researchers trained a small group of foragers to visit a feeder location north of a hive along a gravel road. However, they released the bees from three different sites, and what they discovered is that the dance was even more complex and detailed than they had originally understood. In a diagram of the dance, we learned that it includes spatial expectations, not just directions, a truly intelligent and efficient form of communication. Researchers placed a feeder with a sugar solution north of the hive along a gravel road and trained foraging bees to visit it. One site, as reported, had a distinct path, whereas another lacked these types of markers. Then they let the bees perform their magic trick of dancing to show their friends and indicate where the food was located. They had never visited the hive themselves. Researchers awaited to determine whether any information about the landscape, what to anticipate on the flight itself, if any of that was communicated in the waggle. In a quote, they said, "We employed harmonic radar tracking, a powerful tool for recording the detailed flight trajectory of individual bees." Researchers found that the receivers of the dance, weren't just following the direction and distance indicated by the waggle dance. They integrated the dance's vector information with the memory of landscape features that they might encounter along the way. In the absence of an expected landmark, their search behavior became more exploratory. They flew farther and in less straight paths. They're calling this a multifaceted form of communication. In conclusion, the author states, our experiments address the question of whether the vector information conveyed by the dance is integrated into a recruit's spatial representation constructed from its own experience, and whether this integration occurs within a common frame of spatial reference shared by both the reported, symbolically communicated vector and self-experienced locations. What they found is that the cognitive structure at play here is most adequately conceptualized as a cognitive map. So bees are even more impressive than we had already given them credit for. These intelligent bees aren't just following the vector. They retain a spatial layout of the environment and incorporate it into their navigation. Last quote from the scientists, our study reveals a higher level of cognitive complexity in bee communication. With the waggle dance, bees don't simply follow a blind vector instruction. They integrate it with a cognitive map of their surroundings built during earlier exploration flights. This allows them to form expectations and navigate more efficiently. What do we take away from this, besides the fact that these little girls are, you know, even smarter than we ever give them credit for? When we talk about orientation flights, usually we're just thinking of them circling around right in front of the hive and going up. But it appears something that's been learned is that they are orienting a lot more of their surroundings around them. For example, they know where high hedges are. They know where roads are. They know where trails are. They know where trees and bushes and other things are going to be in their way. And as they're reading or receiving a waggle dance, they're putting all that information in together with what they're learning from the waggle and mapping this whole thing out. It appears consciously, cognitively, before they actually take their flight. They know where they're going. It is amazing. All right, let's get on with our guest. This is going to be a lot of fun today. I'd like to welcome to the show today with a great big aloha, Kevin O'Connor. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning. Aloha, Eric. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Are you kidding? What's not to love about being in this beautiful place? Speaking of beautiful places, you are in Waiohinu, Hawaii, correct?
Yes, down close to South Point on the Big Island.
Which is the southernmost point of the United States of America, by the way.
Yes.
Okay. And there's a lot of businesses that will remind you of that, including our favorite Punalu Bakery. And by the way, they're not giving me anything free for saying that, but you can't drive through without getting some sweet bread and a malasada. Anyway, hey, I met you at the farmer's market the other day. And today we're going to talk about farmer's markets. We're going to talk about treatment-free beekeeping, regenerative beekeeping, all kinds of things. And if you don't mind, give me a little bit of background first.
Yeah.
Like, when did you start beekeeping? Why? What do you love about it?
Yeah. So I started beekeeping in 2006, this spring. I came out to Hawaii that winter and then got a job while I was out here catching queen bees. I love about beekeeping the dynamic aspect of it, how it's like really kind of connects you with nature. I've always been a gardener ever since I was a kid and then made a business out of it. And always also been, you know, attracted to just the natural cycles of nature, the seasonal changes, the different flowers and how they interact with each other and how beautiful they can be when you arrange them, you know, in a garden and landscape certain ways. And always kind of appreciated that different environments and ecosystems require different plants and they have different aspects that how they contribute to the ecosystem, what have you. And honeybees, beekeeping is like a natural extension to gardening because honeybees are so integral to the garden, as well, of course, as other pollinators. But honeybees are something that you can actually manage and work with and interact with on a, you know, more intimate and in-depth level. It was interesting catching queens. I had not really known anything about beekeeping, and it was a really quick, like, deep dive into beekeeping, because you get to know all about all the different aspects of beekeeping and queen rearing, which kind of is just like a quick deep dive into beekeeping. And one of the things that was, like, concerning to me at that time, we started having a lot of, like, we were calling them blowouts, where the little nukes weren't surviving 2 weeks to even allow that virgin queen to go mate, come back and be caught to sent along around the world. We were concerned that, because one of the first jobs we had in the morning of the beekeeping the day, we would have a 55-gallon drum and dump like 7 bags of sugar into that, mix it with water, and then the fumigillin and stuff like that. And I was scratching my head, like, what is this all about? And, you know, feeding the bees, and kind of understood that because it's so intensive with allowing that little nuke to raise the queen, we needed to do that. And that got me interested in natural beekeeping and other beekeeping methods that wasn't so intensive and stressful on the bees, because we were seeing that they weren't surviving. There was this kind of drop off in the nukes lasting and the queens being able to be caught. And that was in 2006, which is like right at the beginning of colony collapse. So yeah, that was kind of our start of beekeeping.
So for people that don't know, some of the largest queen producers in the world and some of the best are here on the Big Island of Hawaii. So were you working for one of them?
Yeah, back in 2006.
Okay. And then you've just sort of taken your own journey from there. Your company is called Bee Boys. So it's you and how many other boys?
Just me and Ryan, just two of us right now.
All right.
Yeah. And then we do have, we work with a couple other beekeepers, Artemis Smiles down on South Point. She does very similar beekeeping practices. And because our, you know, we've grown a bit, so, and we can't handle all of the demand, so, which is good. We're able to work with other beekeepers and grow in that way. Because we only, because of the style of beekeeping, it's very labor intensive. You know, a beekeeper can't really manage as many colonies as large commercial beekeepers do, because of the labor, the different approach that we take.
Well, let's talk about that style of beekeeping, as long as you brought it up. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read something straight from your website. Okay. So hopefully this still applies. And oh man, this is where the controversy begins. And I love controversy on okay. this stuff. No, we like telling both sides of the story on this show. So here we go. Your apiary says our apiary is 100% treatment free. We encourage hygienic behavior in our bees. We allow our bees to raise their own queens. Bees are encouraged to constantly build their own comb. We do not use plastic foundation. We do not use beeswax foundation. Bees are allowed to swarm and not collected. Absolutely no plastic in the hives. This includes plastic frames, feeders, and any component of the hive. We do not paint hives. We do not spin honey or reuse honeycomb. We refrain from pesticide and herbicide use completely. We do not feed our bees ever. We do not move bees for pollination services or nectar sources. We follow biodynamic principles and apply instinctual beekeeping methods. I'm almost done. We do not purchase commercial bee stock or collect swarms. We maintain an 8-year line of genetics. All our current colonies came from the same colony 8 years ago. Our entire apiary is a true family. Okay, where do we jump in? How do you want to explain that?
So yeah, we keep bees basically how they were kept hundreds of years ago before we got too smart for ourselves. You know, we found that through all of our intense research about colony collapse disorder and interacting with the honeybees, you know, a big one lesson we learned was in 2010. So we became keeping bees in Hawaii and then suburbs of Philadelphia, southeastern Pennsylvania. We don't keep bees in southeastern Pennsylvania anymore. We stopped in about 8 years ago. And the biggest lesson we learned in southeastern Pennsylvania was our bees were always kind of struggling until the economy kind of started collapsing in 2008. One of the first things that our neighbors did, because we're in suburbs, you know, it's not agriculture, but it's similar within, there's a lot of chemicals used in the garden and on the lawn. And one of the first things that people stopped doing, because it was easy to cut and save hundreds of dollars a month, not using the herbicide, the Chemlon, I think they call it True Green now, and all of the different strong chemicals to make that golf course green lawn. And what started happening is in our neighborhood, all the dandelions started popping up, all the ground ivy, which is a beautiful little purple flower, clover, violets, all the little wildflowers that live in the lawn that makes for a healthier lawn. It kept it greener longer during the droughts of the summer. And our bees were thriving in the suburbs of Philadelphia. We had swarms. We were collecting gallons and gallons of honey per colony and not using treatments. Yes, we were planting thyme in front of the hive, the bees, and all around in the gardens and stuff, because the bees collect the thyme rosins, propolis, to create their own medicines for the varroa mite. And there's many different facets of it with being treatment-free and having them build their own honeycomb. They start making their cell size smaller and all these different things. And also, yes, you're going to lose bees during the process because the genetics that aren't strong to survive all these different changes and stressors will fall away. And the genetics that are strong and are able to adapt will come forward.
Are you a beekeeper who loves sharing tips, asking questions, and showing off your latest honey haul? Then join The Hive, introducing the Man Lake Beekeeping Community on Facebook, your new go-to for everything honeybees. Whether you're struggling with mites, trying a new winterization method, or just need to know what that weird thing on your frame is, our group is a supportive, spam-free zone for beginners and pros alike. Stop scrolling through endless forums and connect directly with beekeepers and the professionals at Man Lake in one buzzing place. We'll put a link to it down in the show notes. Just click over and join up.
And that's using nature's way. Instead of, you know, getting in the microscope and grafting or doing all that stuff to create, you know, oh, we want this desirable trait or that desirable trait, we allowed the bees to do it because they know how to be better than we do. So that's the approach that we took and that we found success. And then in 2010, in suburbs of Philadelphia, the economy started coming back and people started using the True Green again and spraying their trees because all these ornamental gardens are, you know, they require all these chemical intervention, which isn't necessary. But anyway, the people started doing it, you know, good marketing, stronger, healthier, happier gardens and lawns that are all golf course again. And the bees could not collect enough nectar to make the comb, to make the honey, or to store the honey for the winter. So we found ourselves scrambling, feeding our bees, which we hadn't done for quite a few years. And we were using like a tea mixture, sugar water with a this biodynamic preparation of like mint and thyme and little sea salt and chamomile and to make it a little easier for the bees to digest the sugar. And we were looking at each other having this conversation about like, well, if our bees cannot survive in this situation, what makes, because we've always heard the honeybees are the canary in the coal mine. What makes us think that this is a healthy environment for us? So that's when we kind of made the decision to move full time to Big Island, Hawaii.
It sounds so perfect and idyllic. And it doesn't work for everybody, Kevin.
No, of course not. It works as long as you're willing to take the risks and suffer the losses for the long-term gain. And that's what it is. We're looking at it long-term. We're not looking at it this year, these few months. We're looking at it intergenerationally so that the genetics of the bees is stronger. And yes, if you have thousands of colonies that you're trying to maintain with only a couple dozen employees, you cannot do it how we do it. You're also not going to get the quality of honey and wax and the strength and integrity and genetics in the bees because there's going to be, it's like a patchwork. We think we know, but we cannot comprehend the complexity of genetics and honeybee genetics and the flexibility and fluidity and plasticity that it has as well and its ability to adapt. So we're what we're working on is creating like a landrace bee where we're located, because we don't move them around. We don't do the pollination services. Yes, right now the bee industry, it's geared towards pollination services. It's honey. How many dollars a pound is the honey?
It is so cheap right now. None of the commercial guys are making a living on honey. It doesn't work.
Yeah. And then also, so you have the other aspect, the agricultural aspect, the pollination services. If we were to work with the orchard tenders and be like, say, hey, you know, an idea would be, why don't we park these bees here? We'll have some in-house beekeepers, ours, yours, we'll train, whatever. And then you also have forage for the bees that you plant inter-row, depending upon how it is, or maybe take out a few acres of almonds to plant some mixed diverse plantings. But it's a slippery slope, because the agricultural industry is so intertwined with big chemical, big ag, genetic engineering, genetic manipulation, all that stuff. And they don't want to turn that spigot off. And I get that. You know, once you do something, you create something, it's like, we put all this time and energy in creating this product. We want to be able to sell it. We want to ensure that that market's there. And however, that way of doing business is really destroying our ecosystem and destroying our bees. Like 70% loss last year across the continent, that's not sustainable.
It was crazy how high it was. The initial numbers were 62%. Nobody knows exactly what it was.
Yeah.
But it was well over a million colonies, and it may have been 70%. And in some areas, it was even higher than that. And some people told me in the industry, the reason it was that way is because beekeepers didn't use enough chemicals, enough treatment for varroa. And you're saying it's the opposite, and I'm not the judge here. Okay, I love what you guys are doing. I want to play devil's advocate for a second, because I'm sure you hear it. There are some areas, depending on the climate and stuff, like where I am, hard winters, if varroa levels are hardly anything, they don't make it through winter period. So that's thing number one, is can everybody do it where they live, what you're doing? And thing number two that I always hear, and I don't know what stock to put in this, is, oh, well, if you're doing that, you're sending varroa bombs over to my hives, and so I'm getting varroa bombed by you, so thanks a lot, you jerk.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's everything in between, and I wish we could all do it how you do it. But we either don't all know how, or we just can't where we live. What is it?
So it's both of those. Well, yes, you can everywhere. However, it's going to take time. We can't do it overnight, because it's taken us years and lots of losses at the beginning. And now our losses, we keep around 50 colonies, and maybe we'll lose two a year. Our losses are really low.
And that's genetics, right?
That's what I attribute it to.
That's genetic. And that's what other treatment-free beekeepers tell me. The ones that can do it are like, hey, we have bred for this. The ones that can't deal with it, they die. That's okay to us.
It's hard. It's still hard to lose a beehive.
Sure it is. Because we feel responsible, because we're the beekeepers. Even though out there, you know, in the forest, that's exactly what's going to happen, the survival of the fittest kind of thing.
And I couldn't imagine how hard it would be being a larger beekeeper, having thousands, managing thousands of colonies and losing half of them. It's like so difficult. Sleepless nights, I imagine. So one of the things I think that not only the genetics, not only are we allowing them to build their own honeycomb, which shrinks, they start making a smaller cell size, shrinks the honeybee just a little bit smaller of a gestation period, smaller little feistier bee. That part is great. That part is what we have control over. But we're on a tiny little quarter acre, but we're surrounded by thousands of acres of open space. It used to be old pasture land that's kind of been gone back to forest. And it's like Christmas berry, which is an introduced species, and as well as something they call Hollyhocka, which is another introduced species. But because we have all of this open space that's not treated with any chemicals, and we have an abundant amount of forage through many seasons throughout the year, our bees have the food stock that they need to thrive, and they have the diversity to enable themselves to get the different types of rosins, the propolises, and the different pollens to give them a good, healthy, diverse diet. It's like you think about the diet of a person. You want to have, you know, a healthy diet, well-balanced, all that stuff. We want the same thing for a bee. So when you have bees eating in monocultures, they're not getting a diverse diet. And then when you're feeding them on top of that, it's like eating, you know, popcorn is your main diet, and then drinking soda and French fries. And that's what you got. And that's big ag, unfortunately. And also in a lot of these different areas, we have changed the ecosystem across the country by cutting down forests or raising prairies, you know, plowing, all that stuff, and not allowing for the natural cycles to balance and regulate and offer a diverse amount of forage for all throughout the year. And a lot of other regenerative beekeepers are starting to, I mean, not just beekeepers, sorry, land tenders, farmers, they're starting to not till the land. They're starting to allow the ecosystem to develop, and they're preventing soil erosion. And what that does for beekeepers is it creates all those wildflower habitat. So the bees are going to have the opportunity to have more diverse food. So you have those two things go hand in hand, allowing the bees to kind of do what they do best, is them, be them, and then ensure that we have a diverse, healthy ecosystem for the bees to forage. Once you have both of those, and that's what we have here in Hawaii, then you can do the natural beekeeping, allow them to build their own honeycomb. And I did want to talk some transitional tips and ideas, because when you just go like you want to, okay, I'm going to be treatment-free foundationless rather. The bees, because over multi-generations, they've always been given this foundation, they kind of forget how to build like parallel and all that stuff. When you have a swarm, though, there's something unique. And we don't collect swarms, that's a different story, but we used to. When you have a swarm, they, for some reason, are able, it's like when they swarm, something resets. When they come back, you catch them or you know, you put them in a box. And we do use Langstroth boxes with, but we call it top bar methods. Sometimes we have the full frame, sometimes just the top bar, sometimes the top and just the sides.
Deep boxes, medium boxes, what?
Both, deeps and mediums. Deeps for the brood. We try to do two deep brood chambers, and then we'll build depending upon the year and the age and vigor of the colony. We'll build small boxes on them. And that too, like we allow the bees to take their own pace. Some bees will, and we do walkaway splits, but I want to get back to the comb building. If you're starting with a managed colony that you already have the foundation in there, you can start in the super by doing like every other frame, one foundation, one empty. That way they have that like straight like avenue to build in. And if they start building in an arch, which they like to, you can like turn them around so that they'll straighten it back out. And you get a little snake in there. And also they love facing southeast or south-southeast. And they need to be level, because if you have, it's crooked, the bees build, they festoon, they hold from the top, and they build, and they use gravity and like law of chains or something where they will build that comb. And if it's at an angle, that comb will come down at an angle. So that's important to be level. Also, just keep an eye if you do want parallel frames to flip them back and forth. And then you can get into the brood chamber. You can take, you know, the honey frames from the top that they built and put them on the sides. And you can take out maybe one or two frames in there and do the same thing, allow them to build. They're generally on a, when they're on a nectar flow, they'll build that out real quick within a day or two, and the queen will be laying in there shortly. And you can always do that when you're calling for pollen or make sure that the brood chamber's not honey bound and things like that.
Okay. So patience, be willing to let some bees die. Guess what? A lot of people's bees die even if they're not willing to let them die. So is it really that different? The fact that you're willing to let them swarm, I think, is a big deal too, because you've got brood breaks. It's not like you guys are just lazy and doing nothing. You're actually doing a lot. It just doesn't happen to be chemical treatment.
a lot of monitoring, a lot of just seeing where the bees are, you know, if they're starting to separate, doing the queen cell building, we'll let them do that. And we stopped collecting swarms for two reasons. In Hawaii, when the small high beetle and varroa mite got here, the county decided that they wanted to kill all of the feral colonies in the trees and the caves because they thought there would be vectors spreading varroa mite and small hive beetles. So they destroyed a lot of the feral stock that the queen beaters were kind of depending upon that they didn't realize for their genetics, because the virgin queen will go out and then she'll mate with all the drones, not just the managed drones, but the feral drones as well. And that brings some good in genetic integrity. But when you have, you know, that bottleneck, it doesn't allow that. So we're allowing the swarms to fly to repopulate the area again to create those feral colonies that are essential. And then another reason we don't collect swarms is because when started collecting swarms, or we're collecting swarms, and then we noticed there was this tendency where they weren't swarms. They looked like swarms, but they were absconsions, you know, and that's a colony because a small hive beetle got in there, slimed them out, they flew away, and they were looking for a new home, but they're not swarms. So when you collect them and put them in a box, when you collect them and put them in a box, they weren't having that. There was just this chaos. They weren't building. They were in this like panic mode, and then they would fly away again. And so that's when we stopped collecting swarms, because we don't know. We would go through all this trouble, you know, put up the ladder, climb, and you know, collect, and it'd take a few hours and all this time, and then they continue to fly away. So we just decided to let them be, and we multiply our colonies through what we call walkaway splits. So we'll take three frames of the three stages of brood, egg, larva, and cap brood, and then a couple frames of honey. And then sometimes the queen comes with them, sometimes she doesn't. We're not always that good at making sure we know where the queen is when we do this, in which case, if we do bring the queen with us, then it gives a brood break for the larger colony. And then it creates a very vigorous new colony.
Yeah, new colony. I mean, a walkaway split, it could be either side.
Yeah.
Right? It could be either the side you left or the side that you took and moved. In fact, in a regular swarm, the queen is going to leave.
Yeah.
So I think it's funny that people think a walkaway split should never have a queen in it, or any kind of split for that matter, should never have the original queen. I'm like, okay, once again, we're not working how the bees work for some reason, because we know better. Anyway, let's shift gears for a minute before we run out of time here. Tell me about farmers markets and a little bit about your business, because I think there are a lot of beekeepers that are sideliners or hobbyists that maybe want to move up to sideliner, want to learn how to make a few bucks doing what they love. And they know about farmers markets, but what advice do you have for them? What worked good?
Yeah, before I answer that question, I do wanted to touch base real quick on the like mite balm, small hive beetle balm that you mentioned about treatment-free beekeepers, because that was really a big thing. We were getting a lot of that feedback when we started telling other beekeepers, oh, we're going to be doing this treatment-free, and they were telling us that exact thing. Oh, you're going to be ruining our bees and all that. And cut to 8 years later in Hawaii Island, you know, all the queen breeders, they've kind of tried to move down here. And even though it's not working out for them, it's really windy, hard to breed queens down here. They're asking us for our genetics. They're like, can we have a few drones? Because, so the opposite has happened over time.
Well, and you're also in an area where there's not a lot of other beekeepers right around you that you're going to be mite bombing, if that indeed is a thing. So
the opposite has happened, actually. We find that when the migratory beekeepers move in, the mite count and the small hive beetle count skyrockets. And that's kind of like the washing time. Like when that happens, the strong genetics really shows and the weak genetics falls away. So, but luckily our bees aren't having much fall away anymore. To speak to farmers markets, it's such a great way to connect with your community. It's a great way to let people know that you're there, that you want a healthy ecosystem, and that it's all of our responsibility to ensure that we have a healthy ecosystem. And the nicer that you keep your property, the cleaner and purer your beeswax and honey is going to be for our skincare products and what have you. So that's one way, a great way to interact with the community. And different products we do, you know, the beeswax, we make a lot of skincare products with it. We find that skincare, we get better bang for the buck for making our own salves and balms. And we use all organic ingredients, our beeswax. And because every time we're harvesting our honey, we're cutting out the honeycomb and we're literally crushing it, straining it, letting it the gravity pull it out, and then pressing it a little bit. And then we wash that wax with that water. We make June for ourselves to drink and share with our friends. We don't sell that just yet. And we also make vinegar, honey vinegars from that. And then we, with the beeswax, we make the skincare products, and we do, you know, cold infusions and or heat infusions of different herbs and botanicals. We grow a lot, and we basically replace our medicine cabinet with all of the different salves and balms that we make, from bath body beauty care, you know, age-defying salves, long-lasting deodorants, pain relievers, and that's all from different flowers, botanicals. And some minerals like zinc and stuff like that. Basically, you start small. We started with two salves, and we were doing candles. You know, we were pouring our own foundation and rolling them. That's very time consuming, but you know, you put your value yourself, value your time, and the community values you, your time and your products too. And they actually work. It's the same. We're, you know, working with arnica and cayenne and calendula. Comfrey, these are herbs, chamomile, that people have been using and are relatively familiar with, and they work. Instead of using things that are synthesized from the drugstore, we can use the herbs and botanicals that, you know, have stood the test of time. This is what our great grandparents were using. And people, there's like an attractiveness to that again, because there's this big, you know, AI and data center and all the smart technology, it's creating this big disconnect that we have. You know, right now we're actually having this conversation on a smartphone, you know, Visiphone, instead of in person. And that's where I think farmers markets kind of puts that personal touch back onto it. And it gives so much more value when you actually know the person that's making your products and keeping your bees and where they're keeping them and what they're doing. And it's just exciting. People, you know, and I meet people like you who are also really interested in honeybees.
That's awesome. And I just want to add one thing about the farmers markets. And that is, if someone listening is not a beekeeper yet, please don't go get your honey at the grocery store. Go to the local farmer's market where you can talk to the beekeeper. You can ask questions. What kinds of chemicals are you using? What are the bees feeding on? You can ask them any kinds of questions that you want. Feel very comfortable about what you're doing, and you're going to learn something. Beekeepers are so good at sharing information. You know, I could probably say, hey, Kevin, why do you put propolis in this one salve? And I'll bet you could go on for 20 minutes telling me why.
Yeah.
And it would be good stuff.
Yeah.
So that's an encouragement as well. And hey, you know, I don't want this to sound too capitalistic, but you're also making top dollar at those farmers markets because there's no middleman. It's just you straight there at hopefully a good full retail fair price. And that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And people appreciate that. They'd rather pay good money to somebody in their community than pay it to a big company that's, you know, brought it in from China. You know, no offense to China, but I mean, like, they're getting beat up right a lot. But I mean,
well, but that's a generic. A lot of the honey that you're buying in the supermarket, it comes from out of the country, and frankly, the technology is not there yet to know what all is in it. They're finding a lot of stuff is cut with high fructose corn syrup, with, you know, additives like that that are super, super cheap. And so it's really cheap. And that's the other reason why for beekeepers, it's so hard to make money selling honey.
Well, that's why we charge top dollar. To completely honest, $45 for a pint of honey is what we charge, and $50 if we put the comb in there. And that's a reflection of the time and energy that it's taken over a couple decades to figure this out. And also that creates that higher quality product, and you can taste the difference. And also speaking to, like, if you are conventional or if you're in transition or even organic standards, which can use plastic foundation and use some treatments, even if you are those beekeepers, it's still awesome to offer that honey. I'm not saying it's not worth offering to the community. It's excellent. It's better honey than what you're just saying. It's better honey than what you can get at the grocery store. And you can talk to the people about their seasonal allergies, what time of season do they have it, and then you have the honey, you have the cure for them, the medicine for them. And also honey's been shown to kill staph, you know, the MRSA. Like it's better than some antibiotics. And propolis kills COVID. You know, it's like, it's been proven. There's studies out there that show these things. And this is, instead of using these crazy chemicals on us too, we can use the medicine that the bees are using and the bees are collecting. It's excellent. It's amazing.
We've done a couple episodes on everything apitherapy, from bee stings to propolis to a lot of this other stuff. And I'm all for experimenting on myself with all this. And I do. And I'll tell you what, I had a bad burn on my arm a couple of months ago just from hitting the side of the oven, you know, because I'm really good at that kind of stuff. And oddly, it just wasn't healing. It just was deep and kind of bad. And after a few days, I'm like, I'm just going to put some of our good raw honey right on this. And I was thinking, maybe I should do propolis. I don't happen to have any around here. I'm going to just throw honey right on it, put a big Band-Aid over it so it's not getting everything sticky.
Yeah.
2 days later, unbelievable recovery. This whole thing had closed off and was almost completely healed. And this is not us legally not giving any medical advice, of course. No.
These are our experiences. We're not telling you this.
No, these are our personal experiences, but it's amazing. And I do some bee stings for some things too and love it. And would encourage people to, if you feel like experimenting with some of that, beekeepers out there, go for it. Everything in the hive is good for you. Except maybe small hive beetles, but that's not from the bees. I haven't heard of any tincture for that yet. Hey, we're running out of time. I Kevin, I have to give you a chance to tell us one of your favorite wild and crazy beekeeping stories. Have you thought of anything?
Well, fascinating. The kind of a highlight of my beekeeping career was, so we go to Molokai as well. It's a beautiful small island, a couple islands north of us.
And no varroa mites there.
No, exactly. There's no beekeeping industry. It's very small, like home backyard type stuff, as well as a massive amount of feral colonies. There was, and a lot of, you know, because of that, you're going to get a lot of extractions from structures and what have you. And so we were called, we are asked, and this is, you know, we normally don't do this, but they asked us to help them remove a colony from a church, a small wooden church that was built by St. Damien.
Down in Kalau Papa?
Exactly. Well, the church was not there. The church was up on the top side, they call it. But he had built the church there. But yeah, he administered to the lepers the afflicted in Kalau Papa. And he had come up and he built this wooden church in like the 1800s. It was a double wall construction. So the bees had built a colony in there. And we worked with carpenters who removed the wood and we extracted the colony from there and put it into boxes and relocated it and then sealed it up. And that was amazing. That was like an ethereal experience with the bees and in the church with the history of this ancient structure. Yeah, that was just fascinating. And then otherwise, kind of more of a funny story. I still am afraid of getting stung. Hi, honeybees. It's like, I think, I don't know if it's just me, but it's still, it hurts a lot. You know, it's like a burn. It's like a hot needle and it radiates for me. So it's like, I don't know if I'm just working it up. So anytime I do get stung, I don't cry like a little baby, but I quickly move away.
But you scream like a little girl.
Yes. So it's, yeah, I do not like getting stung. Between the pain and then also the loss of, you know, the bee. It's
yeah, it's all only because the loss of the bee. Hey, you're human. And this is built into our DNA. And that's why the first time that you do a sting on purpose to treat something.
I've never done that. It must be a different experience.
I'm going to come to your place and show you how it works. It's a different experience. It is so hard to do the first time because everything in your DNA is saying, no, 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 no. And you have to overcome that. And it's crazy hard. It gets easier. But it's really hard the first time to do a self-inflicted. Hey, Kevin, we could talk for hours. I'm going to put your website down in the show notes in case people want to find you or reach out to you or order anything from you, which I would highly encourage. The area that your bees are in, I've been down to that area. It's absolutely beautiful. It is so green. It's kind of what you picture of Hawaii. It's just green. It's not like this green desert behind me, which has no bees, by the way, because who knows what all chemicals they use out there. But I'm going to give you the last word. Just one last piece of advice or why you just love beekeeping.
I love beekeeping because you never know what you're going to get. Each season's different. Each harvest is different. And also have faith in the miraculous. You know, the honeybees, they have been here for tens of millions of years. They're going to work it through this little blip on their genetic radar. The quicker that we come together as community to overcome this, you know, kind of self-inflicted wound, because we're creating the problem that we can solve. And we can solve it through beekeeping and coming together and appreciating the natural flow and ebb and flow of nature and the beautiful world that we're so lucky to be a part of.
Beautiful. Mahalo, my friend.
Thank you. Aloha.
Thanks for joining us on Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by Man Lake. If you like this content, I hope you'll share it with a friend. Follow and subscribe to this podcast, and even sign up for our newsletter at beelovebeekeeping.com. Also, just a shout out to Vita Bee Health for their support. We appreciate them. Vita's Varroa Control range of products includes Apistan, Apigard, and now Varroxan, extended release oxalic acid strips. Thanks, guys. And remember, if you're not just in it for the honey or the money, you're in it for the love. See you next week.